As far as vitamin D is concerned, we know, as I mentioned at the beginning, the vitamin D, of course, is important for the formation of teeth, but excessive use or intake of vitamin D might be very, very harmful.
Gordon?
I would like to reiterate that same point, especially something that Dr. Bessie said before, namely, if your nutrition is optimal, you can take barrels of vitamins without them doing you any good at all. Fortunately, most of them are not toxic. We're very certain that vitamin D is toxic, but that is more or less a pharmacological effect, quite separate from its nutritional importance.
We can proceed with our next question. What is meant by exogenous and endogenous deficiency? I think there we can only quote again our friend Bill Shakespeare. And just to, again, check up on it, remember he speaks of fortune or nature either giving a stomach and no food or giving a feast but taking away the stomach. Question 7. What are the major deficiencies in the average American diet? Gordon?
It's perhaps difficult to make any generalizations for the nation as a whole, or certainly for the world as a whole. I should say probably the American diet is most likely to be deficient in ascorbic acid of anything. I'd like to digress just one moment to point out that, in my opinion, scurvy, as it was known to seafaring men over the centuries, and as we see it occasionally, even now, clinically, I think is a multiple deficiency disease. I don't think it's only a lack of ascorbic acid, and my reasons for saying this is that in humans, artificial experimental ascorbic acid deficiency has been produced, and the result is nothing like the naturally occurring disease. If time permitted, we could discuss those experiments, but that's not possible. I think additional deficiencies are probably involving the vitamin B complex. And certainly we know that in certain parts of the United States, especially in the South, there is a marked deficiency of parts of the vitamin B complex where pellagra is an endemic disease. But I would also like to point out that pellagra is probably as much a deficiency of quantitatively and or qualitatively of the protein in the diet as it is of niacin itself.
I would like to reinforce Gordon's point that we are too apt to think of deficiencies as being single. As he mentioned, most of our nutritional problems involve multiple factors. We can now proceed to the next question, which I would like to address to Dr. Adouche. Will the average patient consume a well-balanced diet without following a specific pattern for daily food intake?
No, Dr. Schauer, I am convinced that patients will not consume an adequate diet unless they follow a specific pattern, just the same as they can do nothing else well without following a specific pattern. A woman cannot make a dress well unless she has a pattern. A machinist cannot make a tool well unless he has a specific pattern. Once he has learned that pattern, then he can continue by habit to make a successful product. The same is true with the diet. Once a good pattern has been learned, then the habit has been established and they can go on. Appetite itself cannot be depended upon to give the patient a good diet. I would say that the early habits established in the home are highly significant in the kind of diet that the patient has. Of course, at the present time, many of these early habits are changed because of various pressures that are brought to bear in promoting the use of this or that special food item.
Gordon?
The only dissenting evidence on this point, and I think it's interesting, is that Richter at Hopkins some years ago showed that rats if given a free choice of foods, would eat wisely. In other words, they seem to possess some sort of a biochemical wisdom which would make them eat exactly the dietary essentials which they need. If rats are capable of doing this, certainly humans are not, and I agree 100% with Dr. Radouche.
Now, we
Dr.
can...
Dr. Davis did an experiment with children, with babies, and if they had not first been taught to like other foods, the reports in the literature at least showed that these children did eat a well-balanced diet. It was a very expensive way to feed them because you had to furnish so many different foods.
We'll proceed with question 9. What relationship does calcium intake bear to dental disease? How could the recommended daily allowance for calcium best be supplied? This question, of course, has already been discussed. You will recall that Dr. Radouche pointed out that calcium needs are best supplied by 3 glasses of milk daily, 8-ounce glasses. We certainly agree that calcium tablets have been overdone. There is even a danger of harm because of the false sense of security that may be given to patients for whom calcium tablets are prescribed. Dr. Pancher, head of our pediatric department at the University of Illinois, tells of this experience. A frantic mother called him at night. She reported that her little girl was unable to pass her feces and needed immediate help. The physician found that the feces was practically calcified, and he had to break up the mass to relieve the child. The clinical history was interesting. It showed that the family dentist had prescribed dicalcium phosphate to arrest caries in the teeth of the child. He did not prescribe the dose, but told the mother that it was like candy, she could have all she wanted. In addition, the child happened to suffer from slow bowel movement. The alkalis in the stools from the alkaline digestive juices of the bile and the pancreas united with the excess dicalcium phosphate to form insoluble calcium soaps. In this case, I think we have an interesting lesson. 3 mistakes were made. The wrong treatment for caries was used. An inaccurate dose was given, and the child's general health was not considered. Now, question 10. Are there any dangers attendant upon the reduction of carbohydrates in actively growing children? Gordon?
The answer to that is a definite, absolute, and unqualified no. It is true that there is a certain amount of carbohydrate necessary in the metabolic mixture that is being oxidized at any single time if we are to avoid ketosis. But this can be unrefined carbohydrate, and there is no need of using any specified amount of sugar. We have essential amino acids, we have essential fatty acids, we have vitamins and minerals, but there is no minimum requirement of sugar as such.
I see Rex is raising his bushy eyebrows.
Get me to trouble again here. I agree with Dr. Gordon completely. You don't expect me to think possibly that these would endanger the child, otherwise we would not recommend it. On the other hand, I would like to emphasize that we see to it that the patient eliminates excessive sugars. That is the emphasis. In our studies of caries immune patients, we found that our caries immune students in Berkeley who had never had any caries experience had an average intake of approximately 10 teaspoonful of sugars a day, while a control group of very caries active ones had 18 or 19 teaspoonful of sugar a day. This was the only nutritional difference or dietary allowance for these students. And I cannot see why the carbohydrate restriction should be detrimental to a young growing child.
Again, I think it's important to emphasize the point that Dr. Beck just made, that when we speak of sugar in relation to caries, we, I think, agree that we're not talking about elimination of sugar, but reduction. Bessie?
And I think, too, we want to define this term carbohydrate as not just sugar. I would take issue with Dr. Gordon on the, if we're going to define carbohydrate as carbohydrate, that there is a minimum beyond which you can go. Now, I think it wouldn't be easy to for one to reach that minimum. But you place someone on a carbohydrate-free diet, and you certainly will have trouble. Entirely carbohydrate-free, and I'm sure he would agree with that. That he's talking about a practical problem. Practically, you can't do that, but scientifically, you can. And it certainly would cause trouble.
Just to save time, I want to report that Gordon is nodding his head in agreement. Question 11, on the difference between the growing and adult tooth, has certainly been answered. And this applies also to question 12, regarding the nutritional factors necessary for the formation of sound teeth in the fetus. This brings us then to question 13, which deserves more attention. Is a well-balanced diet sufficient to control or prevent caries? Bex?
Well, in the first place, of course, we have to define as to what a well-balanced diet is. If a well-balanced diet means a low sugar diet, I'm 100% for it.
That was a very concise answer, and we can go on with questions.
Could I raise a question
Please.
About that
Dr.
very concise answer? That Dr. question Dr. says, is a well-balanced diet sufficient to control or prevent caries? That word prevent caries is a big order, and I wonder if we couldn't settle for the idea that if you do keep sugar down and the diet in pretty good shape otherwise, that it may go a considerable way toward preventing caries. But I'm wondering if we can really say that it does what those two terms say in full.
You're willing to settle for control but not for prevention?
Well, I'm willing to settle for the fact that it'll help the situation a great deal, but the prevention is a pretty strong word.
May I talk to this here as a clinician? In the first place, of course, let us remember that we only can prevent a disease if we know its etiology. We are somewhat convinced today that we cannot eliminate sugar whenever we discuss the etiology of dental caries. However, there are more factors that will contribute to the progress of dental caries and also to the prevention. Now, sugar is certainly one of them. And as I said before, if we can design a balanced diet, whatever this might be, in which we keep the sugar down, I am convinced that when all other factors are equal, that we will not have any development of dental decay.
Gordon?
I'm afraid I just don't agree with that. I'm willing to go along 99% of the way, but I'm going to hold out for that 1%.
I think this is one of the questions that we can come back to a year or two from now. This brings us to question 14. Is a malnourished individual more susceptible to decay than a well-nourished person? Gordon?
I should say the answer to that question revolves about the details of the metabolism of mature teeth. We have said already this evening that once the tooth is formed, it has calcified, that there is so little exchange of calcium between the tooth and its environment that for all practical purposes it can be neglected completely. If this is true, then I should say that the answer to the question is that the nutrition of the individual has very little to do with dental decay, with the possible exception of the amount of carbohydrate in the diet, which I always have to put in parenthetically, since Dr. Bex is sitting over here looking at me.
You better.
Otherwise, it seems to me that nutrition has more to do with the disease of the periodontal structures than it does with the teeth themselves. And it stands to reason that it doesn't do a person very much good to have caries-free teeth if they come out and he carries them around in his pocket.
Now let's proceed to question 15. What dietary regulations are indicated in the treatment of rampant caries? I think here we go again back to Bex.
Well, that all has been taken care of, so I think we can go to the next question.
Massler?
I just thought that if somebody here has a sugar appetite, that would be a good time to irritate Dr. Bex.